joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Republican establishment took some hits in yesterday's primary elections. A Tea Party-backed U.S. Senate candidate in Delaware upset nine-term Republican congressman, and a candidate for governor of New York, supported by the Tea Party, defeated a GOP favorite. It was the last major round of primaries before midterm elections in November. Joining me in the studio for analysis of the elections and insights about what to watch for in the weeks ahead, Democratic strategist Donna Brazil, David Keene of the American Conservative Union, and Amy Walter of ABC News. Do join us. I'm sure you have your own thoughts, comments. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Donna Brazil, what was the most surprising outcome in your book?
No question that Delaware was another unpredictable race where the Republican establishment put forward a candidate, Mike Castle, and he was defeated by an insurgent Republican Tea Party-backed candidate. And Sarah Palin has proven to be one of the most effective campaigners this season, because it looks as though every time she gets involved in a race, she stirs things up.
David King.
Well, she does stir things up, but the New Hampshire results will tell us whether she wins every time, because she endorsed Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, who is in a undetermined race with Ovid LaMontagne of a New Hampshire family that's been involved in politics for a long time. So that remains to be seen. But if Montaigne wins that primary in New Hampshire, it will be the ninth race this year in which the National Republican Senatorial Committee's favored or endorsed candidate was upset for the nomination, which tells you something about the attitude about among Republicans about the party establishment.
Amy Walter, Carl Paladino, who defeated Lazio in New York City, said his win indicates a, quote, people's revolution is underway. Is that how you
well,
see it?
It's very interesting. He ran literally as the I'm mad as hell candidate, and there were signs all over the state, lawn signs with that slogan. He said he was going to take a baseball bat to Albany. And in a state that has had major corruption issues in Albany, that's gridlocked up there, major budget problems, that's a pretty appealing message. Now, Carl Paladino, unlike the sort of average person, also has lots and lots of money, which he put into that campaign and really outspent Lazio. But he is another outsider candidate who has sort of captured the imagination of a frustrated electorate. I do want to go back to something that both of these guys pointed out about the Tea Party upsets. I mean, the Delaware thing was certainly a surprise. It wasn't a shock in the way Alaska was, because we sort of saw this building up and we could see it coming. But it's the most consequential of any of the primary results, because Christine O'Donnell, the Republican nominee, is a much, much weaker candidate in the general election. In fact, everybody, all the prognosticators around D.C. have already moved this race from leaning Republican to either leaning or likely Democrat. And so this was supposed to be one of those gimmies that Republicans were going to take to the bank. It was the one of the hope they were hoping for 10 seats. That's what they need to flip control of the Senate. You got to pretty much take that one off the table, and that takes possibility of control.
David
Keene, well,
as chair of the American Conservative Union, tell us why so many conservative voters are disenchanted with mainstream Republicans.
Well, during the Bush years and during the period when Republicans controlled the Congress, many, many conservatives became more and more disaffected with not the stated beliefs of the people they were electing, but the performance of those people once they got into office. And this time around, with the sort of the reaction to the Obama administration and the Democratic leadership's overreach after the 2008 election, and their sense that the economy was headed for a cliff, they've gotten both enervated and fearful, and they're out there. They want to be. They want to participate. They want to change things, but they're not sure that many of the Republicans, the traditional Republicans who are appealing to them for their votes, deserve those votes. And so they're looking for new people. I'd like to say two things. All the, you know, we talk about the Tea Party and trends and all that. New York is sort of sui generis in a way. I mean, Paladino, a lot of people who didn't like Rick, I happen to supported Rick in that primary, but is a rich guy who wants to hold public office. That's not going to have a whole lot of effect, I don't think, in the general in New York. But there are two ways in which that Delaware race is consequential. One is that it does skew the potential outcome, and Karl Rove may have been correct when he said last night on television that it moved the Republican possibility from an 8-9 seat pickup to a 7-8 seat pickup. But consequential in another way, in that the establishment, having lost before the votes were counted, announced that they were going to destroy this woman. And I think what was surprising in Delaware was the margin, not the outcome. And that margin, I think, was accounted for by the fact that when Christine O'Donnell, who I don't know, was moving up, the Republican establishment decided to go after her full tilt in a vicious and personal way. And I think there was a backlash because it was all these old guys who claimed the right to lead the party because they had always led the party, beating up on this little girl curled up in the corner. And I think that accounts for the margin.
Girl, Dave. Donna.
No, she's not a little girl. She's in fact a very tough, polished candidate. She's run before. Christine O'Donnell has a record, and people know it in Delaware. And that's one of the reasons why I think the Republican establishment is very concerned today, because they know that she has a track record of failing to reach out to independents and failing to reach out to moderate, to conservative Democrats. And so this is likely a loss for the Republican establishment. But the Republicans have a lot of other internal problems. If you look across the country this past primary season, we've noticed a trend. John McCain had a very tough primary. His opponent, Mr. Haysworth, has not endorsed him. Lisa Murkowski is still contemplating in Alaska running as a write-in candidate, and they have not come back together. Down in Florida, Mr. McCollum has not endorsed Mr. Scott. And so while the Tea Party is rallying against Washington, rallying against the Republican establishment, they really have not put together a cohesive strategy to reach out to independents and others who might provide the margin of victory. That's why I think today Democrats, the morning after, they're feeling quite relieved that we come out of this primary season unified. We have good candidates. We have a lot of money in the bank, and we're ready to take on the so-called Tea Party, who I believe they've read the mood of the country in a way that will hurt the Republicans this fall.
Donna Brazile, she's Democratic strategist and adjunct professor at Georgetown University. She's also a nationally syndicated columnist. David Keene is chair of the American Conservative Union, a columnist for The Hill. Amy Walters, political director of ABC News. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I'll look forward to hearing you. Amy Walters, when you look at some of the other primaries, let's talk about what happened right here in Washington, D.C.
Right. Well, there, as far as I know, there wasn't a Tea Party involved in this city, but it felt like that in the sense that there was an establishment candidate who was defeated by somebody who, in some ways, was not an outsider either. Vincent Gray isn't exactly brand new to the scene. He's not somebody that people don't know. But I think there's clearly a frustration that is out there among voters, even in places where it seems from the outside that things are going well. And I think this also, what the race to me highlighted was just the very obvious division in the city between certain parts of the city, right? So where you live gives you a perspective very much on how you feel about the mayor. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who live out in the suburbs who had a very different perspective of what people in the District of Columbia should do as opposed to what people in the district actually did end up doing. But I think that Adrian Fenty, despite the fact that the city is really doing pretty well, you know, certainly turned off a lot of folks. There was a lot of concern, especially among African-American voters, about the fact that he didn't seem as concerned about their parts of the city. Education reform, while appealing to many voters, not as appealing to folks, especially those who are in the middle of the system right now, involved in the system, have kids in the system. So, you know, it was a controversial mayor at a time of great anxiety, and you get those results.
Does that sum it up, Donna?
Yeah, there's no question that we have a divide in Washington, D.C., between the haves and have-nots. Surprise, surprise, surprise. Adrian Fenty, let me just say, was my former intern when I worked on the Hill for Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who also won her re-election last night. But he was seen as a very effective mayor. I mean, he was very effective. I can tell you, you know, from potholes to, you know, cleaning up some of the corruption in D.C. government. He made the trains run on time, but he was a lousy politician. This is a guy who ran by knocking on every door across the city, and then he governed as if he didn't want to talk to people. He didn't want to listen to people. He didn't care about what people actually were thinking. And so there's a perception among some in the city that the mayor lost touch with the community that really elected him 4 years ago.
Don like Brazil,
Democratic strategist, adjunct professor at Georgetown University. Short break, and we'll be right back. And we're back with Amy Walter. She's political director for ABC News. Donna Brazil, a Democratic strategist, adjunct professor at Georgetown University, and nationally syndicated columnist. David Keene, chair of the American Conservative Union. He's a columnist for The Hill. We're going to open the phones very shortly. I want to hear a few more comments. David Keene was talking about what happened in New Hampshire, which is still sort of shaky.
Right.
Amy, outline that for us.
Well, we're still waiting for the final results to come in. Apparently, carrier pigeons, I think, are bringing the votes to be counted in the state of New Hampshire. But Kelly Ayotte, who has the unique distinction of being the establishment candidate and the Sarah Palin-backed candidate, was up by just about 900 votes or so. So the thinking is, by the middle of today, we may have an answer as to what the final outcome is, or maybe a recount. This was another place where, and I think this is what's going to be fascinating as we move forward. We can get into a whole discussion now about how credible some of these candidates are in a general election. But let's just say a lot of them do end up winning and going to Congress. That's going to set up
the Tea Party candidates.
Okay. Sorry. If they, you know, this is going to create a very fascinating dynamic for the leadership in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who is the leader right now in the Senate, how he keeps this group together. You have Jim DeMint, who is sort of sees himself as the self-styled leader of the Tea Party movement within the Republican caucus in the Senate. He has backed Ovid LaMontagne, who David mentioned the, just a moment ago, whereas the establishment in Washington backed Kelly Ayotte. He also backed Christine O'Donnell. There's a lot of frustration now from sort of Republican strategists that, you know, Jim DeMint's meddling in these events is put not only put forward more conservative candidates who might not win, but could bring people to the Senate who could be very difficult to predict and could create more chaos once they get here.
How much do last night's results reflect Sarah Palin's power down in Brazil?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, she brings not only national media attention to the race, she brings her brand of conservatism, her credibility as a conservative into play. And remember, she's still seen as she's an energizer. She energizes the Republican right like no one else, I think, at this point in the Republican Party. So she's a net plus for the Republican during the primary season. I don't know how effective she'll be in the general election when more independents are at play. And really, Palin may have the effect of rallying the disaffected Democrats and those who are right now not excited about voting. An endorsement by Palin, a handpicked candidate by Sarah Palin, might energize Democrats this fall.
David.
Well, I think Don is right about Sarah Palin's influence in the primaries precisely because there are a lot of people she has been able to energize. But she has to, you know, to make her presence known in races where it's credible. The example on the other side is the governor's race in Maryland,
right,
where she endorsed somebody who wasn't known, had no money, nobody else was supporting, and was handily defeated by former Governor Ehrlich. So, she has influence, and I'm sure that Ehrlich's opponent did better than he might have because he had Sarah's endorsement, but not much better. So, reality and what you can bring to the race are things that have to be counted in.
Yeah, and I think it's important, just one quick thing, to see if she can put her money where her mouth is here, which is if you're Christine O'Donnell and you got her support in the primary, is she going to come raise money for you in the general election? Is Jim DeMint going to help raise money for her in the general election? Will she go and campaign for a lot of these candidates in the general election? That's a very different
But she has campaigned for some of them, but no, that is, they're going to be out there, not just the ones she's endorsed, but many of the ones that she hasn't endorsed for the good things that Donna said about her, because she can energize their people and raise money for them. And the question is, how much of that will she do?
Here's an email from Charlie in Martha's Vineyard. If some of the Tea Party victories are being called upsets, what does this tell us about political polls? Do yesterday's results show whether we can trust poll predictions, especially as they relate to predictions of Democrats' supposed doom in the upcoming general election?
Amy. Very, 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 very good point. There are a lot of polls out there, and we have to be very careful about them. Mm-hmm. That said, there was really only one public poll recently in Delaware that came out. It was something called an automatic dial poll. It's a robo-poll. You get a recorded message. There are a lot of people who say those are not very good at predicting outcomes. However,
mainly
it was the one poll.
Other polls,
right. However, it did have O'Donnell ahead by a couple of points. Mm-hmm. And that's where people started to say, maybe this is real. When you talk to the pollsters who are involved in the Murkowski race, they will tell you their internal polling showed it getting close. You know, those folks who were involved in that campaign.
That was a campaign that didn't listen.
That's right. So I think that's fair. But I agree with the caller in that we have to be very careful about looking at one poll and projecting out simply from that. We have to look at a whole series of polls. And I think what we're seeing about Democrats in the polling from respected pollsters, Gallup, of course, the ABC News poll, NBC, et cetera, is there is one constant there, and it's this. The first is Republicans much more enthusiastic than Democrats. We obviously are seeing this in primaries as well. The second, more people saying, especially those who say they're enthusiastic, saying they're going to vote for a Republican over a Democrat in the race for Congress. And finally, the really deep frustration that voters have for Washington and the status quo. Now, this makes for interesting cross currents, as we're seeing the anti-status quo means that they're just as happy. Republicans were just as happy to throw out their incumbent as some voters may be about throwing out Democrats. But when it comes down to a general election, the incumbent party is Democrat. And voters are going to have a choice between the Democrat and the Republican, and that sets up very well for Republican
That's true. There's no limit to the surprises and unpredictability of this electoral season, and polls should be used as strategic instruments mm-hmm. to gauge voters' mood. In this case, they are upset. There's a lot of anxiety. But if any candidate out there is relying on their pollster to guide them to victory, let me just tell you,
anyway.
That's right. This is one of those elections, Diane, where I really think that candidates got to just throw everything mm-hmm. out the playbook and mm-hmm. go out there and be among the people.
But what does that mean, throw everything out of the
playbook? This is not a cookie cutter campaign year. I mean, voters, they're in this mood where they really want to hear. They want to listen. They are fed up with Washington. They're fed up with the status quo. They may not like Democrats, but they dislike Republicans too. It's one of these election cycles where you really just got to get out there and mix it up with the people and not rely on all the old playbook.
I think Don is right about that. In defense of pollsters, having agreed with everything, in a time of sort of popular unrest and popular disaffection and involvement, all of these poll outcomes are dependent on turnout. Mm-hmm. And it's almost impossible this year to predict in individual mm-hmm. races what the turnout's going to be. So without saying that they're all a bunch of dummies who don't know how to take a poll, they all are a bunch of people who make guesses that are often wrong, and therefore their results are wrong.
But, David, going back to the point that Amy was making about what happens if some of these Tea Party candidates do get to Congress, and especially into the Senate, what kind of operation is that going to make for?
It's going to be a very different Republican caucus, regardless of how many of them make it, mm-hmm. because a lot of them are going to make it, or at least a lot of non-establishment challengers, Utah, Colorado, places where people who were not part of the establishment won the party nomination and may win the general election. Mitch McConnell is a pretty smart guy, and I think you'll see a different Mitch McConnell with that caucus than you did with the caucus that he had this time, because Senate leaders count votes, not necessarily the votes out in the country, but the votes in their caucus. If he doesn't do that and doesn't change, then you would have two parties in the caucus. You'd have the McConnell Party or the Establishment Party, and you'd have the DeMint Party. I would be willing to predict that's not going to happen. I would be willing to suggest that Mitch McConnell will know how to lead that new caucus as well as he has the last.
You think?
Let's see. You know, listen, it is very different to run as a change candidate on the campaign trail and then try to keep that anti-establishment credential once you get to Washington.
And here's a message on Facebook from Liz. If the Tea Party thinks it's so different, if they truly feel they have a genuine platform, then why don't they form an actual political party?
I don't think
party?
That's what they're about.
Mm-hmm. They don't care about
that? Well, that's not what they're about. I mean,
are they about?
They care very much about the direction of the country. They're very upset with what they see as a fiscal situation that's out of control.
Let me stop David, because this is from Jerry in O'Fallon, Missouri, who says, I know it seems like ancient history, but more interesting than last night's results to me is the primary win by Tea Party candidate Joe Miller in Alaska. How can someone claim to be for smaller government representing a state that receives $7 in federal spending for every $1 it returns in federal taxes?
Well, actually, in defense of Joe Miller, one of the criticisms of him in Alaska during this primary was, in fact, that he's taken positions that he doesn't intend to come to Washington just to get money for Alaska, and he's going to operate differently. And they're saying, well, how can you be a senator from Alaska if you're not going to do what Ted Stevens did for us, which is to loot the Treasury in favor of our voters? I think, Diane, that what the Tea Party people reflect and what a lot of other things have reflected in recent months is that popular opinion on these questions is changing. Remember back to the fight over health care when Ben Nelson got what they call the Nebraska, whatever they call the Cornhusker thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the 1960s, that was a heck of a deal for Nebraska. I think he went home expecting to be carried on everyone's shoulders for cutting a deal that no other state was able to cut. He went home and lost 30 points in the polls in a week because they said, we can't do this anymore. Chris Christie in New Jersey is taking positions that he wouldn't have taken 3 years ago because public attitudes have changed. And I think what the voters are saying is you can't operate as you always have operated because the situation has changed and we've changed.
Well, and let's see if that's really true. I mean, if the number one thing these folks then are going to have to come to Washington and do is, one, they talk a lot about deficit reduction, and we all know what that means, which is have real entitlement reform.
Right.
And I will bet you that votes on Social Security and Medicare are still going to get kicked down the road, that fundamentally there's still, for as much as voters say they want change and they want, I think those things are still
These things are tough.
Yeah.
And whether they accomplish them or not is another question, but that's what the public wants.
Yeah. Well, what frustrates many, many self-identified liberals like myself is that under the Republican leadership that guided the Congress for so many years and, of course, the White House, we saw reckless spending. We saw the budget deficit double. We saw the country go into two wars, borrow money to fight those wars, tax cuts that we had to borrow money for. And all of a sudden, you have a Tea Party, a movement that is against spending in Washington, D.C., when it was many of their so-called leaders, because I associate the Tea Party with the Republican Party, that really got us in this mess in the
first
place.
That's why Mike Castle was retired last night.
David Keene, he's chair of the American Conservative Union, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now. Headphones, please, 800-433-8850. First to Osage Beach, Missouri. Good morning, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. It's just a great pleasure to be talking with you.
Thank you.
I have 2 points. The first is that, I think the Democrats are intellectualizing the hunger, the joblessness, and the desperation on the part of the population. And they need to start getting more gut feelings about people out there. And they have to have an answer to the Tea Party movement. Or, believe me, this is going to take over for the simple virtue of the fact that people are tired of bad government. And this is a factor that brings people together.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Down in Brazil, Democrats have to answer. They've got to do something.
You know, I look at it this way, Diane. Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and Barack Obama and the rest of the Democrats came into Washington, D.C., saw the economy going off the cliff and decided, you know, this is not about the next election. It's about getting things done, getting it fixed, and trying to use taxpayers' money to invest in and getting this economy going again. Now, many Americans did not like the fact that under President Bush, we had to bail out the banks, we had to bail out Wall Street, we had to bail out the auto industry, and President Obama, of course, kept many of the Bush initiatives in that regard, as well as the two wars and the tax cuts. So he's now a big liberal because he basically kept some of these programs intact that George Bush and the Republicans initiated. It's hard to tell what direction to go in when everybody is pointing fingers about how we got in this mess. The truth is that we're not going to come together as a country, whether we're Tea Party or whatever we want to identify, unless we believe that this country still has to get itself together in terms of economic growth and finding a path back to prosperity. That is what's missing in D.C. right now is leadership. We don't have it. We just don't have it. We've got a lot of people that likes to posture and grandstand, but it's time that we come together as one country to figure out how we solve these problems in a common sense way without driving up the deficit, but also we got to invest in the future.
What do you think Democrats need to do now more than what they've done in the past?
Well, first of all, stop spending money unless you can explain where it's going, okay? I'm one of these people that if I'm going to spend a dollar, I'm going to tell you how I spent it and why I spent it, and I'm going to justify it.
I think we spent a lot of money, and I'm not criticizing the Democrats. I'm saying we spent this money to try to do good, to try to get this economy back on its feet, but we haven't explained it. So the American people are frustrated. They're sitting around saying, look, I'm in debt. I got credit card debt. I can't pay for this. I can't go out anymore. And look at those folks in Washington. They're spending like wild sailors. So I think the
Democrats— And it hasn't worked on it.
Well, I disagree there, because you and I both, David, when I drove up here to see Diane and all of you guys, I saw all of these different construction projects. It's working. We got first responders working. We got teachers back working. No, it wasn't enough. But I do believe that we would be in worse shape had we not invested in those critical infrastructure programs a year ago.
Donna Brazile, she's a Democratic strategist, adjunct professor at Georgetown University. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of your thoughts through your calls, your emails, your faxes, your Facebook messages, and your tweets.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Nissan, with the 100% electric no-gas Nissan Leaf. Innovation for the planet, innovation for all. Details at nissanusa.com. By German Embassy and the German Information Center, offering news about politics, culture, and lifestyle at germany.info. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Why great partnerships succeed. Former Disney CEO Michael Eisner on some of his controversial working relationships and why he believes being part of a team beats going it alone. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Before we go back to the phones, I want to ask you, Amy Walter, about Charlie Rangel in New York.
Charlie Rangel, who's had some ethics troubles, well-known over the course of this summer, pretty easily won re-election. Won his primary contest. I think we had looked at this initially thinking that perhaps because of the scandal surrounding him, he might have some troubles coming back. But fundamentally, I don't think his opponent really made a very good case either. And look, bottom line, we've talked a lot about the nationalization of these elections. In many cases, there still wasn't all politics is local. And so when you look in many of these House races, what's interesting is we saw the Tea Party upset in Delaware and maybe in New Hampshire, but Charlie Bass, who's a moderate, who lost in 2006, who would by any means be considered one of the few moderate Republicans in Congress, won his primary to try to come back to get his seat. So I think, you kind of have to remember that, yes, we like to blow these up and say the national politics are driving this, but you still have local people making their decisions.
Donna Brazil, Charlie Rangel.
Well, I've known Mr. Rangel for many years, and he's a fighter. He will fight. He's determined to clear his name before the House, and he's determined to remind voters that for all these many years, he's been a great public servant. He's been a champion for their issues. And with Bill Clinton and many other leading Democrats out there campaigning for him up in Harlem, Mr. Rangel, I believe, came back. He's coming back to Washington, D.C., unless he has a significant challenge in a general election to show that he is going to clear his name.
Here is an email from, Janice, who says, the Republican Party is reaping what it has sown. When Republican leaders allow the animosity, falsehoods, innuendo, and divisiveness of Gingrich, Cheney, Rove, and Fox News to smear anyone who threaten their power, they fan the far-right conservatives that large corporations can finance and manipulate. They created a force that's destroying their party. David.
Well, there's so much of that that I disagree with that it would take hours to go into it. But the fact is that what we have is not something manufactured by anybody. We have an appreciation out in the country of the fact that the people's leaders are not doing what they were elected to do and that the country is off track. All you have to do is look at any poll of Republicans, conservatives, independents, and they're upset at the direction the country is going, and they want to do something about it. In a democratic system, that's what they're supposed to do.
Here's an email from our web. It says, everyone is talking about how Americans are fed up with Washington, the status quo, but no one is talking about changing the system that frustrates us with the redrawing of congressional districts, the huge amounts of money candidates need to run. I truly believe if we were to change every single player, we'll still get the same results. We have to change the game. The Tea Party represents what I think is feel-good frustration, but they are the opposite of the consensus we need to build to move this country forward. Amy.
Very, very well said. And I want to build on, Donna made this point as well, that just, it's the frustration about the lack of leadership in Washington. Look, the system is in many ways not equipped to handle some of the issues that have been put on its plate, but they have to. And in this time of the million tweets a minute and information overload and instant feedback, leaders have to be willing to put that aside and say, we need to do what's good for the country regardless of anything else. I think there's some very important points, though, to make, and All-State National Journal polling came out this week that I think had some fascinating looks at the American public's views on government as well as the role that government and institutions should be playing in the economy. The first thing is, what's different about this election year is that it's not just that voters are frustrated with Washington. They hate all establishments. They don't like banks. They don't like corporations. They don't trust anybody. They trust themselves, period. This could be very dangerous when you think about this is a time when Americans can kind of get very insulated and isolated, which is interesting. The other thing is, when they ask voters, do you think government's a problem or government's the solution or something in between, 35% have the government's always the problem, not the solution. But the other two-thirds either think that they want activist government. 33% say, I want government to have a role in the economy. I just don't think they can do it effectively. Mm-hmm. What that says to me is two-thirds of people in this country want government to have a role in the economy and in making things better. But half of those people think government's not doing it well. Mm. I don't think people hate government. They hate incompetent government. And right now, that's what they've been getting.
All right, to Lafayette, Louisiana.
Who
Good morning.
Oh, yeah.
Graham, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hey, guys, how you doing? Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to just say, who dat, of course, but I think that there's probably a bigger scene at work here, and that's the fact that a lot of people like myself, I'm a former airline pilot, and I used to talk to a lot of politicians flying the Atlantic corridor between Washington and New York, and I got to yuck it up with a lot of politicians and just kind of get in their head just to find out how comfortable they were getting being lifelong politicians in Washington. And I think that there's a lot of people, especially like myself, who sit around here, and we reach out and try to help our neighbors as much as we can, and we can't help but think that the egoic stance of somebody who is arrogant enough to stay in Washington for 45 years, I don't understand how a politician can say, oh, I'm going to be a lifelong politician. They get comfortable up there. And I think that the Tea Party movement, which I don't really stand for, I'm more of an independent. I think change, I mean, I think dichotomy, and I think that differing views is a wonderful thing for our earth. We should, you know, I think we can all agree to disagree and let that be a good thing. But I think in the same sense, we want to see new blood in Washington about every 8 years. And why don't we ever talk about term limits for congressmen and senators?
Well, the Republicans talked about term limits until they became the majority. Politicians share one view, and that is that they ought to be where they are because they're smarter than everybody else. And every once in a while, the public says, no, you're not. You know, I admired Trent Lott when he was in office. He's a good friend of mine. He's the only Democrat who was originally going to run as a Democrat who I ever contributed to. He recently said, you know, he was concerned about these outside candidates. He said, we have to surround them when they get to Washington and make them part of the system. That's what the public doesn't want. And this is a seductive city. People come here to change it, and then after they're here a couple of years, they go home to explain why it's really not in need of change, you know. Yeah. And then after a while, they don't even bother to do that. And then in districts that are contestable, oftentimes they get thrown out. And this is regardless of party.
We need civility. I mean, that's one of the missing ingredients in our politics today. It's not the people we bring to Washington, D.C. Look, I was born and raised in the Deep South, not far from where that young man called from. And, you know, we talk to our neighbors. We talk to our friends. I must tell you, I spend at least 2-3 hours a day calling up Republicans saying, what are you hearing? What are you talking about? Mary Matlin and I were emailing and tweeting each other until 2 this morning about the races across the country. So I really do believe that when people come to Washington, David and Amy and Diane, they forget that they're Americans, that they're people, and they become partisans. And that's a bad thing, I think, in this environment.
To Rockford, Illinois. Good morning, Maurice.
I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, and I can't think of anything more entrenched than the GOP in Washington. I think I'm all for the Tea Party movement. It's grassroots, and that's what's important now, grassroots. It's new blood. I say yes. The Democrats should think about new blood, too, because there's plenty of entrenched, you know, Democrats over in Washington, too. There ought to be time limits. They get too comfortable. They get too important. Their heads get just too big, you know.
And that's the attitude.
That's right. That's true. The great irony, though, is if Democrats do lose control of the House, it will be because people who were elected in 2006 and 2008, the people who've barely, you know, figured out how the metro works and, you know, where the bathrooms are in the Capitol, those are the folks that are going to get thrown out. The entrenched incumbents are usually the ones sitting in those safe districts. They're the ones that don't leave. So, you know, it's always hard because I think David's right. In my old job, I used to meet with about 100 or more House candidates a year, and they came from all, you know, political parties and all sorts of persuasions, but they all fundamentally believed they were going to be different. They were going to come to Washington and they were going to change things. And I think there are a couple of things to remember. The first is it is an institution and you do need to get along with everybody. All right. You're not going to just be a lone ranger and solve this yourself. So that is important. The second is, you know, this the system is complicated and that's not easy to get across in a 30-second soundbite. So I think there has to be, on the one hand, an appreciation for the system's a little complicated. It's not as easy as it looked from the outside. But going to Donna's point, you can't just do it alone and you can't just spend all your time beating everybody else up if you want to really get something done.
Amy's largely correct. But in a wave election like this, there are going to be some people who are going to lose their seats, who nobody expected to lose their seats. We, even before we got to the primaries and elections, for example, David Obie bailed out. Mm-hmm. He was in trouble, and that's why he retired, regardless of what he said after the fact. Your caller's from Rockford. I just wanted to say I'm from Rockford. My father was president of the Labor Council there, and he was a lifelong Democrat, but when he ran for office once and lost, he ran as a Republican.
I don't have such conversions in my family.
Donna, last week you gave Republicans a 50-50 shot at taking over both houses of Congress. Do you still believe that?
Oh, absolutely. It is a wave election, and I'm like most Democrats, I'm worried about the enthusiasm gap. We all know that in off-year elections, turnout is lower, and unless you reach people where they live, where they eat, where they play and pray, it's very difficult to get them excited about this race. And so for 2010, most Democrats want to run local elections, but we have to nationalize it in order to get surge and base voters back to the polls. And hopefully a good number that can stop Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh's handpicked candidates from winning office.
David, prediction from you.
I'd say an 80% possibility of taking over the House and a 40% of the Senate. And that hasn't changed in the last week either, in my mind.
Amy.
Yeah, my predictions on the Senate definitely changed after last night. So I still think that the Senate stays in Republican control. Democratic control. Bite sorry. thank you for that correction. Stays in Democratic control. The House, I think right now that Republicans have the advantage.
Amy Walter, political director of ABC News. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Andy in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I heard a comment the other day that I thought really made a lot of sense. They said every 2 years a campaign comes around, and it reminds the Democrats to do what the Republicans do every day of every year. I mean, the Republicans are kind of perpetual campaign mode. And I want to go back to a question earlier about why doesn't the Tea Party, form its own party? And I think the answer for that is they already have a party. They're all Republicans anyway. I mean, I know that your conservative guy there will disagree with this, but they're just the far right of the Republican Party. When you got people like Dick Armey and the Koch brothers, behind a lot of this movement, it's an illusion that this is some type of separate thing. It is still just a far right, as if the Republicans haven't been going far to the right for decades, but now it just seems like it's really going much faster and much harder to the right. And I don't agree often with Karl Rove, but I think he's right on this one, that they really just undermine themselves, because when it comes to the general, they're not going to appeal to the mass in the middle, really.
David Keene.
Well, the election is going to be about the Democratic leadership, has been stated here before. I find it interesting that there was a poll recently that showed that people who had equal disdain for both parties were going to vote Republican this fall by about 58%. And that tells you something about attitudes out there and about the nature of an off-year election. People try to ride things like the Tea Party movement when things come up. You remember Nancy Pelosi initially said it was a grass tops movement and that the insurance companies were calling people and telling them to go to these rallies. I've been involved in trying to gear people up and get them involved for years, and I can tell you, unless they're interested, anything you do and any money you spend is irrelevant, because people have a way of expressing their views and turning out when they want to. Many of these people are Republicans. More of them share Republican attitudes, but there have been polls done of the Tea Party people, and they are not what your caller says they are. They're much more than that.
Donna Brazile, there have been some suggestions that if Republicans win control of the House, they're going to launch an investigation with Obama as the main target. What would they be investigating him for?
Well, first of all, I want to say that overconfidence can be fatal, especially when you still got to get out there and rally people to your cause and get them out to the polls in November. I've heard the same thing, and I saw Congressman Issa the other day on CNN, and I said, Congressman, what are you going to investigate? I mean, what has gone wrong? I mean, do you want to investigate where the stimulus money went, how the tax breaks have worked? I say, is there some malfeasance that I should know about? He said, no. He said, look, I really think that we should just, you know, be able to take a look, good look around and see if there's anything. But he said that that's not true. I want to take him at his word. I hope that if Republicans are able to make any incremental gains, and of course, I don't want them to make any, I hope that they come back to Washington, D.C. with the idea that they want to get this economy going, that they want to, you know, continue our progress so that we can end the war in Afghanistan, and that they're ready to roll up their sleeves to work with President Obama, who will still be the president, to try to continue the reforms that he's put in place on Wall Street and on climate control and education and the rest. Well, I hope that's what Republicans will do.
What do they
I hope they won't pursue the Obama agenda, but Don is exactly right. When you win, you wake up the next morning thinking the voters want to do everything you want them to do and that you want to do, and that's not the fact. Winners tend to overreach, and the Republicans have to come to town in January dedicated to solving these problems. Sure, they have to have oversight. No, they shouldn't go half-cocked in a political vendetta against anyone.
David Keene, he's chair of the American Conservative Union, Don Brazil, Democratic strategist, professor at Georgetown University, Amy Walter, political director of ABC News. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.